Ladies and gentlemen, welcome wrestling fans worldwide to Knoxville and the Great Smoky Mountains for the Ron Fuller Tennessee Studcast.
6 feet 9 inches tall, 265 pounds.
This historic podcast from one of the most respected and successful wrestlers and promoters will follow the footsteps of the largest and oldest wrestling family on the planet.
The Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller.
Through 93 years and four generations.
The Stud has arrived.
Old school or new fan, this unique broadcast will educate and captivate as Ron details decades of professional wrestling's growth with truly unforgettable stories.
I want those people out there at home to hear the Stud.
Sit back and enjoy the ride with the Tennessee Stud.
The Tennessee Stud. You will learn that name. You will remember it.
And now,
the Stud is here.
Please welcome your Studcast host of television and radio fame, Tony Basilio.
Oh, you will learn that name. You will learn, ladies and gentlemen, that story. His name is the Tennessee Stud. My name is Tony Basilio, awaiting the arrival of the great Ron Fuller, 94 years, three generations. Step by step, note by note, we unpack it here at a beautiful Knoxville, Tennessee. Where else? I can still hear those hallowed echoes coming from the stands, reverberating. Over there at Chilhowee Park, the Knoxville Civic Coliseum. Ladies and gentlemen, put your hands together, meet and greet the great one himself, the great Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller.
Good day, my man. Nice to be here. And beautiful Knoxville, you're right about that. God's country, I call it. Sits there in the edge of the Smokies. Beautiful, beautiful place to live. Wish everybody could come and see it, and a heck of a lot of people do right there in the Smoky Mountains National Park. Most visited park in America, and there's a darn good reason for it. It's one of the most beautiful places in America.
You know what's incredible, Stud, about doing this program is, and you were talking about this great place I live in, didn't mean to step on you there, but you're talking about this great place that we have as a common history of Knoxville, where we emanate from, is that there is such a tremendous history, but there's such a tremendous appreciation for you and your story. And in the last 3 months, as we've gotten the Studcast off the ground, and you know, it's always hard to get something off the ground. I don't care what you're doing. If you look around even at the podcast world, many will come and go after a couple of episodes. People will start out with the greatest of intentions. It's difficult, though, to pull it off. It's difficult to see something to fruition, which you've been able to do in your career in many different respects as people get to know you and they'll learn that about you. But what I love about what we're doing right now, Stud, is that several weeks back, Arcadian Vanguard and the great Brian Last decided to take us under his wing. And Tennessee Stud, man, he has blown us up. That guy has blown us up through the Arcadian Vanguard family of podcasts.
Yes, he has. Yes, he has. And you know what's really incredible about it, Tony, is like you're saying, a lot of podcasts come and go, and we're an independent. We're not affiliated with anybody else. We do this out of your studio, which is a tremendous facility in itself, but it's just me and you, and we are the Tennessee Studcast, and it is pretty amazing where we are going and where we have to pick up a distributor as big as that in our first few weeks out there over the air. This, I think, will be our 14th program. I believe this is our 14, number 14. Pretty amazing. I'm very, as I always say, and it's always the truth, I'm humbled. I'm humbled by all of it. I'm humbled by the reaction I get from the fans, and the comments that I see are just phenomenal. I run a lot of them on my website at TNSTUD, TennesseeStud.com. People's comments, we try to change them every week because there's so many of them that are just wonderful. It's a wonderful situation here that we've gotten ourselves into. We are having some tremendous success early on. It's amazing. It's an honor to be here with you. It's an honor. I got to give the credit back to my old granddaddy Roy and to my dad Buddy, because they laid the foundation. I wouldn't be sitting in this chair having these discussions had it not been for the two of them and what they accomplished in their lifetime. And we're going to continue on with that today. Maybe we can go back. I'd kind of like to go back and cover just the end of Memphis one more time, because that was a tremendous place for my dad to go in his second endeavor as a promoter. Had phenomenal success. And explain real briefly again what happened there in Memphis that we had to leave, that he decided he had to leave.
It's an incredible story, Stud. I'm thinking all week after last week's episode, I've been thinking all week about that, about the conflict between your father and his father, and basically his father saying, hey, great job down in Memphis. It's been the one territory I haven't been able to get my hands on. Well, I hope it was fun for you. So go ahead and share, as we're in the early 60s here, and we're in Memphis, and you're still a young boy, and share the story with us.
Well, we talked about it at the end of last week, but I want to kind of go back to it because it sets the tone for a lot of things that are going to come in the future. Dad has made a tremendous success out of Memphis. He has lit up Memphis. Like I said way back, he took that torch that him and Roy seemed to have in their hands to light up wrestling fans everywhere they went, and he did it in Memphis in a way that had never been done before so well that town became one of the greatest wrestling cities in America. I wrestled there many, many, many times, my brother and my dad, back in the 70s. We're going to get to that in the future about those actual matches that I've had in Memphis myself. But this is a great city. Roy is sitting in Nashville. Roy and Nick Gulas are partners. They're looking at what's happening in Memphis. Roy has a tremendous amount of pressure that he can exert upon Dad through the Tennessee Athletic Commission, because Roy is a contributor to the governor. Dad's not a contributor to the governor, and Dad doesn't really care for athletic commissions. He has a personal vendetta against athletic commissions because these guys are VA. There are veterans that are on these commissions. Most of them have no knowledge of wrestling, a little knowledge of boxing. The commissions are a sports commission, but what happens, it's an illegal commission because it only manages wrestling and boxing. Now, you play football in that state, you play pro basketball in the state of Tennessee, any other professional sport is not touched by that athletic commission. That athletic commission wants to take 10% right off the top of what you draw, and they don't even have a knowledge, most of them, of what wrestling is all about. Most of them have never been to a match and probably don't watch it on television. And these guys take it upon themselves to side with Roy, who wants Memphis. He would like to get his hands, as you said a minute ago, on the best wrestling city in America at this point. And he pulls some strings with the Tennessee Athletic Commission. They give Dad a real hard time. And he basically just says, take it. I'm leaving. Unheard of. You build a territory, you put your heart and soul into it, your blood, sweat, and tears, and then somebody says, you can't do business the way you want to do it. And they're not doing that in all of the cities in the state. They're requiring him to do something that Nashville's not doing, and Chattanooga and Knoxville, as an example, the three other major cities in the state. They're able to do these things that they want to do, but they're really sticking it to Dad by saying, you've got to stop doing certain things that other people in the state can do. And so he basically, being the kind of hard-nosed guy he was, he basically says, you can take this town and shove it. And that's exactly what happened with Memphis. He shoved it right up the athletic commission, and they in turn rolled over, and Roy and Nick got their hands on Memphis, which is back to being Roy and the type of guy Roy was. That's the way he did business. He was pretty cutthroat. He ended up most of the time getting what he wanted. And in this case, he did get what he wanted. And what happened here is it really put a bad taste in my dad's mouth. He not only left Memphis, but we went back to Mobile and he quit wrestling entirely. He went to that farm in which we used to own that he had sold to the Fields brothers, and they're running company now called Gulf Coast Wrestling. And we lived in a house trailer on that farm by one of the lakes that he had built 10 years earlier. He did not wrestle anymore. He didn't wrestle for 4 or 5 months. He got up every day and he went out and just piddled on the field. You could tell he was really down. He was depressed by what had happened to him. And I don't think he wanted to go back to wrestling at all. It was a bad time for him. And we end up doing some work on that same farm that we did when we were younger. Now we're about, I'm about 12 years old, 13 years old, still in grammar school. And we are back doing in the same school we've been. In our lifetime, Rob and I now, we're in the sixth grade, and I've been in 5 grammar schools already in just 6 years in 2 different states. And we're about then to make a move after he finally gets past where he's at. And he starts to feel like he wants to go back into the business and he wants to get involved again in it. We get a call from a personal friend of his that he had met in Memphis. During those years in Memphis, he was a printer and he was on the biggest printing company in Memphis. Dad did a lot of business with him because Dad was a great marketer. He could utilize that company. And the gentleman really was a huge wrestling fan. Now, this guy had gone into Arizona, of all places, and he was starting to try to operate wrestling in Arizona. Arizona had practically no history of wrestling at that point. We're in the early 60s. There's no wrestling there. There's television stations, but they don't have a wrestling program. And this guy gets in touch with Dad and he says, I'd like for you to come and be a partner with me in this venture in Arizona. So we pack up from Mobile after being there for probably about 4 or 5 months. And we go there and it turns out to be the landscape is for people that, you know, this is such a marvelous country we live in. And because I've been so many places and we've moved so many times, I've seen so much this beautiful country of ours and all the wrestling I did all over the country and in other parts of the world. It's a fabulous country we live in. Arizona has one of the most unique landscapes of all. We go to Tucson. It's the home of the Saguaro cactus, big old monster cactuses, big as trees, some of them, huge, huge things. You see things there. I, as a young boy, see things that most people can't see. You come from the South where you got lots of trees and you've got lots of green grass, and you go to an area in which they have no grass in their yard. People actually put little tiny rocks into their front yards and backyards, and they come in with a truck and spray paint them green. And that's your grass in Arizona. It's getting those dry. So, I mean, you see things. I'm looking at yards driving down the street and going, what in the heck is going on here? They're painting rocks and making it look like grass.
How old are you at this point?
The seventh grade. I'm going to junior high. I've never seen anything like the landscape. You've got these mountains that sit behind our house in Tucson that are probably 3,000-foot mountains. They don't have a single tree on them. They don't have anything on them but little scrub cactuses up to a certain point. I remember seeing the first tumbleweed I ever saw in my life. I was playing football one day, and a tumbleweed came rolling across the field that we were playing in, and I had on no shoes. I'd never encountered a tumbleweed, so I ran across the field and stomped the tumbleweed to keep it from rolling. I found out the tumbleweed is full of briars and stickers, and it's the last thing you want to stomp. So you learn things when you travel. And my dad used to always say, when we complained and when we started to travel, we went to a bunch of other places. But he used to say, boys, travel broadens your mind. And I think he was really correct about that. We had an opportunity to live in a different part of the country, to see a different type of atmosphere. It was more when you're in the South, you had a lot of Afro-Americans. When you go to Arizona, you've got a lot of Mexican people. It's a different culture. It's a different landscape. It's different totally. And just to give you an example, I'm in the seventh grade, so I'm now into junior high. I go to a junior high in which it's so crowded in the city of Tucson that Arizona's growing like crazy. So Tucson has double classes in every junior high. So they run a class from 8 in the morning until 2 in the afternoon. They take an hour break, and then you have another group of students that come in and stay there from 3 till 9 at night. And I was a 3 in the afternoon till 9 at night student, never having been to school at night before. And they had no school buses like you do in the South, where they take you, pick you up at home, basically, in the front yard, and take you to the school and bring you back and drop you off. I rode a city bus, and I had to walk 5 blocks, catch a city bus, and walk that 5 blocks every night at 9 o'clock to get back home. So I'm experiencing things that I've never experienced before. And he's experiencing things probably that he's never experienced before either. I don't think Dad had ever been to Arizona before. So we're out there in Arizona. We're trying to build another territory. We're working with a gentleman who knows a great deal about printing, but he knows very little about wrestling and the wrestling business. So it's a pretty tough cookie. We have some wrestlers there. Dad has some wrestlers that one is a great Mexican wrestler named Jose Lothario. Turns out to be one of my dad's best friends. He is a talented guy. He speaks English pretty well, and he obviously can speak to the Mexican people in Spanish. And he does interviews in both languages. He trains. He's so talented, and he lasts so long that he ends up training Shawn Michaels, WWE fame, was trained by Jose Lothario in Houston, Texas, before Shawn becomes a big star. He's a great wrestler. He draws Dad a tremendous amount of money. He gets over big time there in Arizona and becomes a big star. Some of the other people that are there at that time are the Baby Blimp. We've talked about him before. He's still out of Dyersburg, Tennessee. Now he's in his late 30s. He's past his prime probably, but still able to move for a big 300-pound guy. You have Don Fargo and Jim Dalton, one of the best teams you'll ever find in wrestling. They had a gimmick that was probably one of the best I ever saw. They went into the ring. They wore six shooters. Each guy had one six shooter. They would load those guns with blanks, and then they would introduce them. When they introduced them, Don Fargo was an extremely talented guy. He could do everything. He was a fast draw artist. He was so good. He trained guys that were in the movies to be able to shoot fast because he was so good at it. He taught Dalton how to pull the gun, and they would pull the trigger, unheard of. Very few guys could ever do this. He would pull the trigger. They would both pull their guns, raise them into the air, and pull the trigger and just run their fingers across the hammer. And it would go ping, 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 ping. They would do six shots in about 3 seconds, both of them at the same time. It's like, bah, 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 bah. The fans would just go nuts. It would like scare the heck out of them. And then once the roar and the pounding was over, the smoke would fill the arena. It was a great intro for a match. And then they went out there and produced once they rung the bell, which was even more important. So he had that group of guys. He had Sputnik Monroe, follows him there from Memphis. You know that he's going to do his thing. It was difficult for Sputnik to be as popular and as significant as he was in the making of Memphis because he did not have the Afro-Americans there that he did in Memphis, and that's what really got him over. So he never got to the level he did in Memphis, but he was still a star there. He had another guy that he called his brother Rocket. Rocket Monroe, Rocket, they tag-teamed together quite a bit. Dwayne Peel. Dwayne Peel was an old-timer from Memphis, basically. His son wrestled for me as one of the Nightmares, Ken Peel. He was one of the Nightmares for me for many years. And he was there for quite a while with us. Great group of guys, great group of talent. They started to really crank up Tucson. Things went very well there. Then after about 6 months, Dad decides that he wants to become a farmer, which is kind of strange. But he decides that he was kind of on and off about wrestling in that early time frame. And I can kind of identify with it because I did the same thing when I started wrestling. When I started in 1970, I wrestled in Georgia for 3 months. I went to Tampa and wrestled for 2 years. Everybody else lived in Tampa. I went down to West Palm. They needed a promoter there. They sent me there to give me a little taste of what it's like to run a town. And I went there and I got disenchanted with wrestling, and I decided I wanted to sell real estate. I did that for about 3 months, didn't wrestle at all. Then I decided that I wanted to build fiberglass septic tanks, which was a tremendous business. Had I stayed in that, might have done tremendous in that, because we're in West Palm Beach, Florida. It's 1972 at that time. So there's a lot of growth going to be in that area. And fiberglass septic tanks were acceptable there. They worked there just fine. And so I tried to get out of wrestling myself. So I know how I kind of had Dad felt. It was like a hot and cold with him. He wanted to stay in the wrestling, and then he would just turn totally against it. So we end up leaving. We end up leaving Tucson after about 6 months. We went so far back in the hicks that they had to pipe in sunshine. We went 60 miles southeast of Memphis into Mississippi. And we went 7 miles outside the city of Potts Camp, Mississippi, into a little town called Bethlehem, 7 miles outside Potts Camp. Like I said, he got so far back in the woods that I really used to say, Dad, they must pipe in sunshine back here because nobody can find this place. He buys 2,000 acres of land. It's Mississippi good land. I mean, it grows everything. And it's just a tremendous place to grow crops, a tremendous place to grow kids, a tremendous place for families. I got a real taste in about a year's time there of what farming is all about. And I found it to be one of the most appealing things I'd ever done in my life. And we as a family were probably happier on that farm in Mississippi than I ever saw us as a family. A lot to be learned from living in the country, man, and a lot to be learned from growing your own stuff and planting it and watching it come up and plowing it and doing all the things that needed to be done. We raised everything there. We raised cotton, which is a tremendous crop to grow. Cotton is, you know, we're going to get a long way from wrestling today, but, you know, we're talking history here and we're telling the family story. This is so different and unique that, you know, I got to throw some of this in there. You know, we grew cotton, and cotton is a tremendous crop to grow. You plant it, you got to spend your whole 9 months cultivating it. You got to chop it. You've got to spray it. You've got to do all the things you got to do. And we were back in the days when you used to hand pick it. So when it finally gets ready to be picked, you go out there and you drag a big old cotton sack behind you and you stuff those cotton balls in there. You get yourself 100, 150 pounds of cotton. You know, you've done a day's work. And my mom used to work right with us and go home, cook lunch, come back and work with us. We'd plow that sucker. I got to wear at that age, and he always driving the big John Deere's and doing the plowing and baling hay. And we pretty much ran a farm's life. It was really totally different than what we'd done before.
What's incredible about your story is I was doing a little research while you were talking about the population boom in Tucson, because invariably, Stud, people hear you talk and they go, ah, man, I mean, that guy's full of shit. I mean, there's just no way. Your story about them having to double up at schools. I just want to read a graphic to people just for a second, just so people can get an idea of what we're dealing with here. From 1940 to 1950, population in Tucson grew by 27%, 35,000 to 45,000. From 1950 to 1960, which is when you guys are arriving in the early 60s, the population of Tucson grew 368%. Now, that, my friends, is the deal. That's what you're taught. When you said, well, we had said schools at night, I can see why your dad would go, you know what, the hell with this. We're getting out of here. I don't even know how you'd get around a town that would grow like that.
It's amazing. You know, you kill me doing these things, man. You got the quickest hands I've ever seen when it comes to Googling or however you get this information. It's pretty amazing. I had no idea it was 300%, but I do know that going to school at night when you're 12, 13 years old is a pretty scary experience. And when you ride that city bus, that really jacks it up quite a bit more because you never know what you're going to get. Arizona could be a dangerous place back in those days. I think a lot of those people were coming across the border, no doubt. Tucson's not that far from the border, so it's further south than Phoenix, so they would stop into Tucson, I'm sure, before they worked their way further north. And it was a dangerous place to live, and getting on that bus every day in the afternoon was not a problem, but getting on that bus at night to come home and deal with it wasn't just school kids on the bus. It's everybody on the bus. It's regular people on that bus. It's a strange experience. That's a pretty amazing figure. I had no idea, 300%. I mean, obviously, they're an explosion there. And that's why they couldn't build schools fast enough. They had to do these double sessions, daytime and nighttime. I never went to any place else in the rest of my time in school that had that situation.
I've never heard of that. I'm sure most people listening to this right now, no matter where they are in the world, the thousands and thousands of folks that take this in are probably going, I couldn't even imagine. If you're in an area that grows that quickly, infrastructure-wise, how do you get around? And then I'm also thinking about your dad there just for a brief period of time trying to promote wrestling in the midst of that environment where everybody's just trying to survive. I would imagine entertainment's the last thing on your mind if you're in a spot where the population's grown 300-some% in 10 years.
Well, oddly enough, they had a Disney World of their own in Tucson. Let's call it a Western Disney World. It was called Old Tucson. And you could go to that place. I don't know how big it was. I know they had to draw 50,000 people sometimes during the weekend day. And they would have old shootouts. And it was like a big, long city made for the movies. It was just put up with the exterior, basically, of the even the stores. When you opened the saloon door, there was no saloon in there. It was just the front. The fronting of a saloon, and they would have gunfights, they would have arguments, and they'd have microphones on the two cowboys, and they would go come out of the saloon, step out there on the street, and bang, bang, one of them would go down. It was an entertaining little spot, but it was totally different. I'm pretty sure, I wonder if that place is still there, the old Tucson.
It is still there. They call it Old Tucson Studios.
I'll be darned. And it was about like a movie. I told you, it was kind of like a movie house. And when you went to we would walk down the street on a old wooden plank street in front of all the storefronts. And when you got to the saloon, I remember pushing the door open to see what it looked like in the saloon. And there was no saloon. It was nothing back there. It was, so I was like, geez, what kind of place is this? So it was a strange place to live, Tucson. And when you think about it, Tony, Tucson is not the biggest city in Arizona. Even as a young guy, I was beginning to have a little of the instincts of what it takes to build a territory. I kept thinking to myself, why are we living in Tucson when Phoenix is so much bigger and it's not that far away? And it turns out, as we're going to talk later on, not this episode, but probably next episode, we're going to find Phoenix. We'll find our way into Phoenix. But between that time that we leave there in Tucson and he kind of gets cold again on wrestling and he says, let's become farmers, we end up in this little podunk junction in Mississippi raising cotton and corn and soybeans and cattle and horses and pigs and chickens. I mean, we were farmers. We did everything that farmers do. And like I was saying, I found it to be one of the most wonderful feelings to be able to watch things grow and to grow your own food and to live in a quiet area. It was really a great change of pace. And I think the family enjoyed it more than I can ever remember any place that we ever went prior to that.
That's wild. I mean, you guys are in the middle of the circus with wrestling, and then your dad gets called by this farm life. And what I thought you were going to tell me is we were completely miserable. It sounds to me like that's one of your favorite memories of childhood. Gone to that, what'd you call that thing, Potts Camp, Mississippi?
Potts Camp, Mississippi. It's about 60 miles southeast of Memphis. It's about halfway between Memphis and a city called Corinth, which is one of the bigger cities in Mississippi. I've wrestled in Mississippi quite a bit. As time went on, I learned a lot more about Mississippi. In fact, we wrestled in Potts Camp. In fact, I have a story about wrestling in Potts Camp. My dad at this time, although he had turned sour on the sport, he was really starting to take an interest in Rob and I to make wrestlers out of us. And he, first place he started was a dip rack. He said, you guys need to improve your upper body. And he built us. He was a welder anyway, because he built anything he wanted to. He cut some pipes and he built us a dip rack. And for people that don't know what a dip rack is, it's basically two parallel bars about the width of your shoulder, and you get your hands on it. It's raised a little bit off the ground so that it's up about shoulder height. You get your hands on and you push yourself up straight so that your arms extend. That's called a dip. And it turns out that that's one of the best exercises in the world for improving your upper body strength. So Dad takes us both out. He builds us a dip rack and he says, boys, y'all going to learn to do dips. And we started, we couldn't do any, couldn't even get stood up on the bar. He'd take us by the hips. We'd get our hands on top of the parallel bars. And when we try to push up, we couldn't straighten our arms. So he would push us up and hold us. So we started out just being able to keep your arms stiff and stay up there for 30 seconds. Then you drop down. You couldn't stay up any longer. We went from there and we started finally being able to do a dip. And then finally he says, I'm going to give you guys, whoever can do the first 10 dips, I'm going to give you a $20 bill, which is a big amount of money to us as kids back in those days. So I remember I beat Rob to getting the 20 bucks. I'm older than Rob. I had obviously a better chance of doing it than he did at that age. And so we learn how to do dips. We start then wrestling some. He starts teaching me rather than what he taught me when I was 5 and 6 and 7. In that third grade, when he taught me how to drop guys on their heads and that type of stuff, now he started teaching me how to beat guys, how to do the inside toe hold that it became his hold, the fuller leg lock. He taught me quite a few shooting holds. And so in high school, one day he brings his wrestling out of Memphis. They talk him into wrestling in that gym at that high school in Potts Camp, Mississippi. So I go down there like every other kid. The gym is full because wrestling is still extremely popular out of Memphis. The TV comes out of Memphis. Everybody knows what wrestling's all about, and they still remember his name. And that night, I go into the ring, and I'm sitting with some of my friends. I'm in the eighth grade, and there's a guy comes to the ring and gets the microphone before the matches even start, and he says, hey, I'm so-and-so, and he goes, I think this is all a bunch of phony crap here, and I've come down here. I think I can beat any of these wrestlers. So I'm sitting up in the stands like everybody else, and I'm like, what in the world is going on? So the place gets silent because the bell hasn't rung or anything. This guy's introduced himself, and he's challenged all the wrestlers. So for a while there, no one comes out, and then out comes my dad, and he comes down to the ring, and he gets the microphone away from the guy, and he goes, look, I don't know who you are. And he says, you certainly don't look tough, you know, but he says, you're really being kind of stupid to come out here and challenge somebody who can hurt you. And you're really making a big mistake here. And he goes, I don't think you're really ready for a big time wrestler. And so I'm sitting up there with the friends of mine, and we're like looking at each other like, what the heck's he talking about? And he goes, in fact, he goes, I got a kid here that's in the eighth grade, and he's somewhere up there in the stands. Ron, come on down here, he says. come on down here and wrestle this guy. And then he tells the guy, he goes, this kid is 13 years old, or maybe 14. I was might have been 13, 14. And he says, if you can beat this kid, then I'll wrestle you. It became the mantra for Dad and me for the future. Dad used to always do it. We'd had a lot of guys come to the house, a lot of guys that challenged. And he used to always say, if you can beat this kid, then I'll wrestle you. He never had to wrestle anybody, ever. So I'm at eighth grade. I'm embarrassed to death. I don't look good. I'm skinny. I'm small. I'm not big at that point. The guy's laughing. When I get to the ring, he looks at me and he's laughing, like, you know, and he takes the microphone away from Dad and he goes, you seriously want me to hurt this boy of yours? Dad says, yes, if you can hurt him, hurt him. So that makes me feel real comfortable. I'm like, are you kidding me, Dad? Come on, what the heck? So we get in the ring. Anyway, I end up getting this guy in the inside toe hold and Dad's leg lock. And he screams like crazy and he gives up and they ring the bell and raise my hand. It's my first win in wrestling. I'm in the eighth grade. I raise my hand. I've gotten my first win. And I go up into the crowd and sit with my buddies again and they're all patting me on the back. I'm a big star. You know, I hated him at first. You know, I thought, why would he do that to me? And as time went on, and this happened to me so many times in life, in the next 3 or 4 or 5 years before I started actually wrestling, that I realized that I could beat almost anybody from just a little bit of stuff that I knew. And it was a good lesson for me. It gave me a lot of confidence at an early age.
As you hear the Tennessee Stud, we're going to take a brief time out here, step away. We're going to come back and get into some questions from our audience. And Stud, this is always a wonderful time. Your story is incredible, man. I mean, that tale, your dad's got to be nuts. You're in eighth grade there. But we've got to step away here for a second, come back on the other side. Stud, you ready to tee up some viewer mail as we continue?
I love it. I love it, man. Let's see what they got for me today. Let's put that saddle on the horse. We're going to ride him on in here.
I love it, man. Saddle him up. Let's do it on the other side as the Studcast continues after this.
This is Studcast number 14, featuring Stud stories as told by the legendary Ron Fuller, the Tennessee Stud, and hosted by Tony Basilio. This Studcast will continue you in a moment. Attention Studcast fans, we're proud to announce the release of a specially designed Studcast t-shirt now available at the Stud Store at tnstud.com. Show your style and support with this first ever extraordinary Tennessee Stud t-shirt. It has logos on the front and back. It comes in all sizes, including double and triple XL, and that includes shipping and handling. Take a look now and be the first to wear this beautiful t-shirt. Also, coming in the next 3 weeks is the most requested item by our fans. Thousands have asked how they can own Studcast and play them whenever they wish on a platform other than the internet, especially for older fans that don't have internet access. We will offer on the Stud Store a limited edition collector CD imprinted with the Stud logo. This complete series of CDs will each contain 5 episodes of Studcast with a special introduction and closing thank you by the Tennessee Stud himself. The first should be available soon and will feature Studcast number 1 through 5, and every 5 weeks a new CD will be available to add to your collection so that every fan can own a piece of the Tennessee Stud forever. It makes a great gift for older fans, family members, or anyone that is a collector or just wants to relive the stories. So, Stud fans, at the conclusion of today's episode, go to the website at tnstud.com, tnstud.com. Click on the Stud Store, get your t-shirt, and thanks for riding with the Tennessee Stud. You are back seated ringside on this edition of the Ron Fuller Studcast.
Tony Basilio back with you on your Ron Fuller Studcast. And now comes a tremendous time in our weekly visits with you, the listener. And that's your interaction with the Tennessee Stud. And let's begin with Jeffrey Archie, easy for me to say, out of Nashville. And he asked the following. In the Tampa Snake Pit, did any of the guys that came through there pass and end up becoming professional wrestlers?
Well, that's a really good question. The Snake Pit was probably in operation for, I would say, 4 or 5 years. And I was there kind of in the early years when there were only a few of us that came in there. Now, I assume he's talking about the actual fans that showed up that want to wrestle the wrestlers. There were a few of us in the beginning, Hiro Matsuda, Bob Roop, Jack Briscoe, Don Curtis, myself. You know, there was a nucleus of four or five guys that were just down there shooting with each other every day. And occasionally these marks, let's call them, guys that came in that thought they were going to be tough and that thought they were good. And I don't think, certainly none of them that I remember in that era went on to become wrestlers. But let's take it another notch. Let's go on into the future, into the late 70s. There is one that became a pretty big name before it was all over, and I think he got his first test of action in the ring in the Snake Pit, and that was Hulk Hogan. Terry Bollea actually was his name, okay? And Terry Bollea comes down at 6'8", 9 inches tall and 310 pounds or around 300 pounds, body that he still has today and the body that he had all of his wrestling career, and wanted to do what so many that had come there before him did. He wanted to have a shot in Snake Pit. He wanted to see if his size and strength could turn him into being a wrestler. And his experience, and I was not there, obviously. At that point, I'm running my own company in Knoxville, and I don't know anything about him, but I hear stories of what happened on that day. And he goes in the ring. I don't remember who he shot with, but I do know that that day they broke his leg. And the story was that I asked about later on because I knew Hulk. In fact, I wrestled Hulk in a couple of his first matches that he ever had. He was wrestling for me in my Pensacola territory. That's how he got his start, was wrestling for me. And he went into the Snake Pit. They broke his leg on purpose because I think they were afraid of him, for one thing. His size, he was immense compared to most wrestlers at that time. And at this point, Terry Bollea, he's not Hogan yet. He's still Terry Bollea. He goes to wrestle for me in Pensacola. He gets well. He goes back to the Snake Pit. And I don't know how he fared in his second time in the Snake Pit, but I do know that we got a call. Louis Tillette was booking for me in the Pensacola office. He said that Louis, he's a Frenchman. He goes, Ron, we got this big guy down here. They sent him from Tampa. And he's so big, we need somebody your size to wrestle him. And I fly from Knoxville to Dothan, Alabama on a Friday night. And I go in the ring first, and I see who will become Hulk Hogan in the future start down to the ring. Strangest looking guy I ever saw at that point. No one, unless you were a part of that promotion in that time frame or a fan in that time frame, you would not know him to be, would not even recognize him. He had black hair on his body. He had shaved his chest in the shape of a triangle. It was out at his shoulders, and the triangle went down to his stomach and his tights in the middle of his tights. It's a strange looking thing. I mean, I'd never seen anybody shave their body in that fashion. He did not have the blonde hair at that point. It was a darker hair, and his size was big. He was a big guy. And so I wrestled Hulk in one of his very first matches in Dothan, Alabama. So in answer to the gentleman's question, I would have to say I know of one for sure that made it out of the Snake Pit and actually made it into the ring. And not only did he make it, he became probably one of the most famous wrestlers of all time.
Now, there are some folks who look at Hulk Hogan and say the guy couldn't go. And there are some folks that look at Hulk Hogan and say, who cares? The guy was a tour de force. And there are some people who say he could go. What say you about Hulk Hogan?
He did not have the training that he should have had. Had Hulk been in that Snake Pit and gone there and shot for a year, he would have been a whole different entity in the ring, a real tour de force as a wrestler. He was huge in size and body mass. He was very strong, obviously, but he had no skills, and he really didn't have the proper training that most wrestlers got. For instance, as an example, I've trained basically from the time I was 7 or 8 years old all the way up until I started actually wrestling in the ring. I had a lot of shooting background, and then I went and learned to work after I learned to shoot for many years and spent a year or close to it doing that alone without having a single match. Hulk didn't have that advantage. He started kind of with no knowledge of the sport, no background in the sport, and trying to become a star. If it hadn't have been for Hulk's size and his charisma, you know, and I like that word because it's really true. Some guys make a tremendous living not just being who they are, but it's their charisma. Dusty Rhodes is another example of great charisma. You just, something about him when that bell rings and you see him walk to the ring, you think, this guy's something different. He's something special. Hulk had that going for him, but he did not have that background and that training that he probably should have had. Had he had of that, he would have probably been a better performer in the ring. But you can't deny a guy that becomes the star he becomes. You know, you just feel like, you know, in his case, I think he could have been even better.
Next question. Bobby Belk, Vernon, Alabama. You were the Tennessee Stud. After you retired, how did Robert start using the Tennessee Stud name? We're going to get some heat between the brothers here.
Really, this is a good story. You know, that's a great question, because when I left wrestling in 1988, I was finished with it. Vince was cranking up his machine. I saw the future before it arrived. I knew that the time had come. Wrestling's time, as it had been in the past, was over and done, and things were going to change dramatically. A lot of guys didn't see it, or they just couldn't leave the sport. Now, I was pretty lucky in the respect that I had a college education. I had played ball in college, basketball, the University of Miami. I had paid other dues, and I had learned things in business. I studied some marketing in college, and it really served me well as my life went on. I luckily got into a sport that I knew nothing about, it, hockey, right in that time frame. Within a year of when I retired, I end up in the hockey business in Nashville, Tennessee. And my brother is still wrestling. And he comes to me and he says, Ron, are you finished? And I said, yes, I'm finished as a wrestler. I'm never going back to wrestling. And I firmly believed that that was the case at the time. And he said, can I have your jackets and your boots and your mask and your trunks? And he started asking me if he could borrow those. He says, do you have a problem if I become the Tennessee Stud? And he's my brother. I love him, you know, and I wanted to see him continue to have success. He was working for Jerry Jarrett out of Memphis. They were wrestling a lot into Texas. They were traveling into Von Erich's area in Dallas. And that Tennessee Stud moniker and my robes and all that stuff helped him to establish himself under a new identity. And it made him successful. And he did a great job of it. As time went on, things changed, and I end up coming back to wrestling a little bit there in the early 90s, and now I'm certainly back in wrestling again. I'm certainly talking about it anyway, and when I came back, it became a little contentious matter between my brother and I. It's still there today. Now he says, you're not the Tennessee Stud. I'm the Tennessee Stud. You know, well, he's only the Tennessee Stud because I said he could be the Tennessee Stud, in my opinion. Now, if you heard Rob, in fact, we had a conversation about this just a couple of days ago, and I said, I wish I could get you on my studcast so you could tell that story. And that story was about how I went and got my robes back and my boots back and took them away. I stole them out of his closet. That's the way he put it. You stole my robes out of my closet. And I said, Rob, those were my robes. So we almost got into it again, just standing and talking about it. We laugh about it, but there's a certain amount of realness to this argument about who is the real Tennessee Stud. It's kind of fun in a way, and it's given us a lengthier career based around that name.
And Rob, if you're listening, I'm on the Real Studcast, by the way, so don't you dare try this at home. Cordell Everett Jr. out of Fayetteville, North Carolina, wants to know the following. And by the way, Rob, I'm talking right to you, big boy. you know where I'm at if you want to come get some. Cordell Everett Jr., Fayetteville, North Carolina, says the following, or asks the following. How did you manage to stay on top of the business end of things so long while other companies didn't last?
Good question. This kind of goes right back into the last question in a way. I brought up the fact that I went to the University of Miami and I studied some marketing. And I learned a few things there that helped me not only in my wrestling businesses, but in my hockey businesses. And later on, as an ADT franchise owner in the Tampa area, I learned how to market. I learned how to create concepts and ideas that drive business. And I was able to do that when it's concerned in this particular area. I was able to utilize, I'll just give you one example. This is when Vince was just becoming powerful and we were operating Continental Wrestling. We did television in Birmingham's Boutwell Auditorium on Monday nights. Gordon Sully was the commentator. Vince's modus operandi was to come into your biggest city and run the same night you ran. So he comes to Birmingham. He brings Hogan, who had wrestled for me, that I had helped train. He brings Honky Tonk Man, who had wrestled for me, that I had trained. Wayne Ferris becomes the Honky Tonk Man. He brings Brutus the Barber Beefcake, who was my trainee, who had wrestled for me. Young guy, personal friend, close friend of Hogan. He runs across the freeway, on the other side of the freeway, in the Civic Center, which is 1,000 seats. My building's about 8,000, 9,000 seats. He brings his number one group, a lot of them already introduced in years earlier by me in my business down there. And so I sit down with my brother and Bob Armstrong, and we talk about how are we going to handle this. So what we do is we put together a two-ring battle royal. We give the fans a two-ring battle royal that night to compete across the street from WWF at that time. And we dropped the ticket prices $1. Normally, we would raise the ticket prices $1. But because we had that competition next door, we dropped the ticket prices by $1. Start of the matches, they started 8 o'clock, we started 8 o'clock. I go out on the stage and I look and there's not a seat in the house. We've sold out. Within 20 minutes, the first match from their building, because we're friends, they're wrestlers and I have wrestlers that are wrestling for me, and they want to come over and see how we did, because they have 1,000 people in a 15,000 seat building and we have 9,000 in a 9,000 seat building. In other words, we blew their butts away. And they came in the back door and walked out there on that stage by me and went, wow, how in the hell did you guys do that? You know, because they had been already taking these little tours around other territories that they were chewing into, and they were going to dominate and they were going to kill in time. And they were accustomed to that full house. And when they saw us with the full house and them with a crappy damn house, it demoralized them. Their heads were hanging. They came in one by one. Hulk came in. Honky Tonk Man came through. Brutus the Barber came through. A couple of other might have been Ted DiBiase. A couple of other guys came through, and all of them walked out there. I watched them. They didn't know I was even there. A lot of them didn't see me, didn't speak to me, and I watched them shake their heads like, wow, what in the hell? So I guess that's an answer to your question. You know, we managed to stay and hang longer than most people did because we utilized some creativity along with good talent. We had great talent. We had one of the best wrestling programs in America, as good as their wrestling program. Our commentator, in my opinion, with Gordon Sully, was better than their commentators. Our talent was better than their talent in a lot of cases, because a lot of those guys weren't great workers. And a lot of my guys, all of my guys, I felt were great workers. So I thought we could stand the test of time, but I could see in the future that we weren't going to last any much longer than anybody else. And I just made a decision that it's the time had come to quit.
Stud, awesome answer. Who's your winner this week on the Studcast?
I kind of like that last question there. I think that's a great one. That Cordell?
Yeah, Cordell Everett Jr. from Fayetteville, North Carolina. What a great question by him. And to hear you talk about that, I can't imagine what it's like to be involved in something that your family was literally involved in the inception of it. And then for you to say, you know what? You got to know when to hold them. You got to know when to fold them. I'm sure we'll unpack that later on, but that couldn't have been an easy deal for you.
Oh, of course not. I mean, it's giving up your life, everything you were born and raised to do. But it turns out that I was pretty much correct about it. I mean, there was no competing with it because of the national television structure. It was just not going to happen. And maybe fairly smart for getting out when it was still sellable, when it was still able to deal it to someone else. And I was able to sell. We were able to sell that business to a company, a guy who owned television stations. We had had our day. It was very good. I did not realize, but to me, it really was the end of wrestling as the way it used to be. And it's a sad darn thing. We've talked about it before, and we'll talk about it in the future, because when we get there, we'll go into real depth about my feelings and what I think actually happened to wrestling.
It's a shell of itself. And Stud, one thing that's not is this program. It remains vital, and it remains vital because of the push that's been given. I almost feel like people that enjoy this podcast are our promoters. They're giving us the push. They're deciding whether or not we're going to continue to do this week after week. And then there's the great Brian Last and people like him. And then there are all kinds of talented people who have come beside us in this venture. And as we're out of time on this episode, man, it's pretty awesome to think about what's going on here with the Studcast.
Oh, it certainly is. I saw a quote the other day, oddly enough, and it was from Jim Cornette. Now, I've been doing these Stud stories on Jim Cornette's experience, his podcast. Jim Cornette called me the Johnny Cash of storytellers. Now, I didn't know Johnny Cash was a storyteller. You know, I assume that's because I'm an old Southern boy, and I guess I do sound like a Johnny Cash in some ways. But I thought it was a compliment, a very good compliment. Brian Last, we've mentioned him a couple of times, and Arcadian Vanguard, the distribution company that has selected us among the many, many choices they would have to put into their podcast network, I think it says a lot for what we're doing here and what's happening here. It's just really humbling to me. Never ceases to amaze me how people are accepting this, how I'm getting this reputation of being a great storyteller. I just come in here and do the deal, man. I just love sitting here and this microphone stuck in my face. It almost feels like it's back in the day again, you know. I'm looking for the red light on the camera that's not there, but I still enjoy the opportunity to tell my story and to be able to talk about this great sport and how it developed from my grandfather, Roy, and through my dad's time. And soon now, it's a chronological story. And I know fans of this broadcast and our Studcast here, they realize that I'm trying to do this chronologically. Soon we're going to be to my day. I'm going to really be able to tell some stories. You know, because most of my stories come from my personal experiences. I've been talking about Roy's experiences and Dad's experiences. I'm going to talk me and Rob and Jimmy and Roy Welch and Jackie Welch, all the Fields brothers' sons, all of those stories. We're going to get to the big time, and I'm really enjoying it.
I love it. You know, look, I'm steeped in football with what I do. I host and own my own radio show in Knoxville, have for a quarter century. You can find me at TonyBasilio.com. We do a post-game show. As soon as Tennessee football games go final on that live stream, also on my app, which if you want to download it, there's a ton of great content there. And we do a lot of history. So if you enjoy this history stuff, we do a lot of Southern college football history on my site as well in various podcasts and whatnot. And then also we've got a program on Sunday nights that the Stud has been nice enough to let me plug here called Southeastern Sunday, which airs from 7 to 9 Eastern live across many platforms, including Facebook Live, Periscope, etc. So, Stud, that's about it for me. Anything else you'd care to add here? And let's go ahead and put episode 14 in the books, my friend.
All right. I would like to say, you know, we haven't really mentioned much about our website. Still out there is TNSTUD. That's TennesseeStud.com. We're on everything now, thanks to Vanguard. We're on iTunes. We're on Sketcher. We're on Podcast Addict. We're on Google Play. We're able to be found everywhere. It's just rocketing our numbers, exploding them. We were just, for a long time, a website. It was the only location you could go and pick up this studcast. And now this studcast is worldwide, and our numbers are rocketing. And I want to thank fans. I just really want to thank, and I also want to ask you, fans, from me personally, if you enjoy this program, please tell your friends, because I think as we do these, we're 14 episodes in now, people are going to want to go back, going to want to listen to number one and number two and number three. Before the story gets into the 40s and 50s and 60s, let's start telling people to listen. You need to go back and listen to this. You need to tune in and hear one of these, because I get these comments, Tony, all the time that say, Ron, it's just phenomenal what happened on your studcast, and we just love it so much. If you can convey that to your friends, I think they're going to love it just as much as the ones that listen to us every week. It's a great thing to be a part of. It's a pleasure to be here. I can't get my saddle off fast enough. I want to wash the old pony down a little bit and wipe him, brush him real good, because next week we're going to be right back up, throwing that saddle on him again and taking off out into the wild. We're going back to Arizona next week, when that's a perfect place to ride your pony.
You damn straight. And for the great Tennessee stud, and I mean the great Tennessee stud, and his name is Ron Fuller, not Robert Fuller, this is Tony Basilio wishing you a great studcast week. Let's come back again, and once again, tee it up, saddle it up on the studcast.
Thanks for joining us today for this historic studcast. The true story continues next week. So full Nelson your friends and point them in our direction for another ride with the Tennessee Stud.
One, two, three.
This is David Summers saying so long from the Great Smoky Mountains. This studcast is distributed by Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network.